You're listening to the newest episode of Adrift, written and read by Doyce Testerman. Every few days, we'll bring you another installment of the story as it's written, as part of an insane overcomplication of what should be a simple NaNoWriMo project. You may be downloading these podcasts via iTunes or Podiobooks, and if so, I'd like to invite you to come by my website, doycetesterman.com, to comment and join in the conversation, or you could contact me directly at doyce@doycetesterman.com. With all that said, let's get on with the story. Chapter 2. Daddy, tell me a princess story. She is lying back on her pillow, the covers pulled up and tucked in tight, and looking up at me. Oh, I give her a sad shake of my head, full of regret. It's pretty late, Bug. How about I tell you one tomorrow? In the time it takes me to say these words, her lip has begun to tremble and her eyes take on the sheen of impending tears. She's not acting. Instant, full-scan mood swings are simply part of the package with a kid less than 3 years old, especially one that's tired. If she were doing it on purpose, it would never work. At least that's what I tell myself. But there's no art or artifice in this, and I relent. I'll tell you what. Shh. I brush away an early tear with my thumb. I'll tell you what. I can tell you a short princess story now, or a long one in the morning. You decide. She smiles and ducks her head, as though she's discovered a loophole in my proposal that I didn't notice and doesn't want to give away. A short princess story. Now. I gasp at her cunning ploy, and she giggles the way only a triumphant toddler can. In my mind, the way only she can. Okay, we'll do a short princess story now. She nods, her face shifting from glee to solemnity in the space of a breath. But not too short. I raise an eyebrow and look at her skeptically. She giggles again. Please. Okay, okay. I settle back onto my heels next to the edge of her bunk, just across the room from mine, in the largest quarters we have in the ship, and ponder the ceiling over us, papered with her unrecognizable but precious works of art. The princess wanted to leave the castle one morning and go exploring in the forest, so she... No, Daddy, no. She lays her small hand on top of mine and shakes her head, deadly serious. You say, once upon a time. I peer at her as though this is some strange alien concept. Once upon a time? She nods, her dark eyes on mine. That's the way you do it. She is, of course, right. In those days, she always is. All right, Bug, lay back. She does. And I begin. Once upon a time. Every ship had a smell, the unavoidable consequence of taking living things and forcing them to cohabitate in a sealed, pressurized box floating through the harshest environment conceivable. It didn't matter how fastidious the crew was, or how industriously the Atmos scrubbers worked, there just wasn't anywhere for a smell to go. Every cooked meal, every spilled bit of food or lubricant, every drop of sweat, every drop of blood, it all accumulated. If you lived there, you got used to your ship's particular stink, but it always made docking with a different ship and opening airlocks a bit of a shock, like kissing an ugly stranger open mouth. Planet-side scouts like the Binturong could at least land fairly regularly. This led to equally regular cleansing pogroms initiated by the ship crews, who would disembark on assignments or shore leave and then return, only to be knocked to the ground, sometimes literally by their own stench. For ships without atmospheric capability, any of the larger military cruisers, the much-vaunted luxury liners, generation ships, and the like, it was worse. There was simply no way to throw open all the doors and hatches and let a little fresh air in. Inevitably, even the best-cared-for ships accumulated a distinctive reek. Then there was the Drift. Uncounted thousands of ships piled one on top of the other, accreting steel and stench into a moon-sized, multi-millennia-old, cohabitated box in space. Put another way, the Drift stank. "Keep an eye out for someone likely," I murmured to John. He acknowledged my words, but wore an expression that put me too much in mind of our talk back in the kitchen. I worked the muscles in my jaw and leaned in close to him. Whatever it is, get it out now, while we're still near the ship." He had the good grace to look apologetic and leaned in to be heard over the noise from the hangar without raising his voice. Not sure what we need the guide for. I know you said you'd never come back, but it's not like you don't know the place. We damn near used to live here." He shrugged his shoulders, adjusting the satchel at his back. I waited a few more seconds, but he didn't say any more. Didn't mention Burns. In a way, his question was a comfort, a legitimate concern about what we were doing instead of why, and it told me that I wasn't the only one distracted enough to miss the obvious. I nodded with my chin toward the space in which we docked. It was vast enough to induce a kind of vertigo, not helped by the unreliably weak gravity in the area. At a guess, I'd have said it was part of an old Helchum bulk cargo hauler. It had that kind of organic wet feel to the distant walls. The place was active and noisy, but could hardly be called crowded. "Recognize this dock?" He looked again when I asked the question, but was already shaking his head.
"Nope."
"Me neither," I said. "But by Deirdre's calculations, this was the nearest open access point to Manifold." He frowned at me as though he hadn't caught the last few words I'd said. Then his expression cleared and he tipped his face toward the nominal ceiling of the cavernous hangar.
"Sure. Right. Damn."
He shook his head, looking in my direction, but not directly at me.
"It's been a while."
"It has." I turned and followed his gaze, scanning the nearest locals, some of whom were idling in the vicinity of the ship in hopes of a job or a handout. "Over 10 years, so figure that the whole place is," I shrugged, "half a click deeper than it used to be?"
"Maybe more," John replied. "Probably a lot more if we're above Manifold. Stupid shunts always drop dead ships where there's the most traffic."
That was something I hadn't considered, but he was right. "So, a click or two of hiking to get into areas we know?
Heading toward the one place we'd go if we ever came back," he finished.
"Yeah, we need a guide." I savored a bit of satisfaction at that, but didn't say anything.
"Probably a Remy," he continued, his eyes scanning the crowd. "Burns doesn't like Remy's."
The offhand observation, grounded in the realities of the current situation, killed my sense of victory as quickly as it had come. John stepped down the shallow gangplank and motioned toward one of the nearest loiterers. I watched the conversation, but it ended when it became evident the two couldn't bridge the language barrier. Many of the remnant species didn't speak or understand any dialects common to Caliban and the Concordant worlds. Some didn't see the point, as we were relative newcomers. Others, those with longer memories or more complete histories, actually had sanctions against ever again speaking a tongue used by our kind. From a historical point of view, this was a frustration, as those species least likely to deal with us were also those best equipped to explain us to ourselves. From my point of view, it was just a pain in the ass. I watched John try more locals and keyed my comm.
"Deirdre."
"Captain." The girl treated words like jump fuel.
"See if you can raise Mac on that frequency I gave you."
I considered John's estimate of the growth of the drift in the area. "You might need to punch up the signal power."
"Affirmative. Message?"
"Bearcat." I cut the comms and wandered down to join John.
"Any luck?"
He looked irritated.
"The ones that don't know what I'm saying, I don't mind. The ones that do, and tell me to fuck off in the name of their great savior, or holy rebel, or shimmering space vulva."
He rolled his head to the side, and I heard his neck pop.
"They abrade my generosity and good nature."
I chuckled. "Think we should get Yorn out here?
And start a holy war?"
John glanced back at the ship, then at me.
"I don't know if the drift needs that kind of fun."
"He speaks a lot of dialects," I pointed out.
"Just for the ones that shoot at us," he replied. "Makes it easier to shout insults."
I felt the spark of annoyance. "Remind me, why did you hire him?" He raised a warning finger.
"I was following orders."
"I don't..."
"You had a very specific skill list," John continued over my protest, "and added to it was this, and I quote, find the most disagreeable, weaselly bastard you can. We're doing a job. That's it. I don't want anyone getting attached."
"Well..." I tried to think of a retort, but nothing presented itself. I had told John exactly that, and we both knew why.
"Good work on that, then." "Thank you, sir."
"Such a thing as overachieving, though." My tone was dry. "It'll come up in your next review."
"Noted." He sighed. Is it all right if I say I miss Mira?
It is, I said, my voice going quiet. I miss her too.
A moment's pause, a mourner's silence, surrounded us. It occurred to me that coming back to the Drift was a bad idea for more reasons than the various individuals who might want to see a corpse with my face on it. There were too many memories here, and most of the ones closest to the surface were unpleasant, like the abandoned ships that accumulated on the outer skin of the Drift itself. I shook the morbid thoughts away and lifted my head.
All right, I said, raising my voice. Let's find someone in this hulk that understands what we're saying and wants to earn some money.
Jit believes I am your necessity to make businesses with the survival savior,
a voice purred in response. That was how we met Billabil.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Adrift, written and read by Dois Testerman. This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, visit creativecommons.com. Adrift was first conceived as a serialized flash fiction story, told 140 characters at a time via Twitter, and in fact continues today and every day as an ongoing story. You can check it out on Twitter at www.twitter.com/finris or on my website at doistesterman.com/adrift. Our intro music is Invisible Walls by Revolution Void off their album Increase the Dosage, available from Jamendo.com. Our outro music is Struttin' by Triad, also available from Jamendo.com. There are many people to thank for their help and input on this project, but the two that jump right out at me, sometimes literally, are my wife Kate and Tim White, perhaps best known in this arena for his Return to Northmoor podcast. One of these individuals has been an unfailing, unflagging, ever-optimistic beacon of support and positive thinking. The other has given me tremendous technical help, suggestions, and advice as I learn how much I don't know about podcasting. Which one is which? I'll leave as an exercise for the listener.
Speaking to this tiny box, through wires, words, walks, strutting down browser blocks, worldwide transmission talk, fuzzy flicker FM balls, DRM dash to the walls, podcast, broadcast, signal, no noise, global infinite internet choice, music chunks get it all for free, major labels don't get me, contracts kiss my industry, I'll sing the system to its knees.